across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlove.
On this Friday morning, it's June 23rd, 2023. Welcome back to the second hour of Up North News Radio, National Take Your Dog to Work Day. So you have my permission to do that. I don't know about your boss. I don't make the rules. It's just National Take Your Dog to Work Day. So do what you will with that information. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from Dan Schumacher, who is athletic director again. His retirement was rather short. We'll find out where he's the athletic director once again, and we'll talk a little bit about sports. We'll talk to Mark Jacob, former editor at the Chicago Tribune, about media coverage of some of this week's big stories, including another instance of billionaire-sponsored corruption in the U.S. Supreme Court. And if you missed our last hour with Kia Vakil, as we talked about some of the national political headlines of the week, you can always catch what we do as a podcast or through the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us. But you can also subscribe through Apple, Spotify, all the usual places. And if you're listening live and want to join us here, 844-967-2789 is the phone number. But my guest right now, Sachin Chetta, is a progressive consultant who is perhaps, for many people, most frequently seen advocating on behalf of fair maps in Wisconsin, but certainly plenty of other causes as well. Sachin, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. Thanks so much for having me today.
Hey, my pleasure. And when we saw each other a couple of weeks back, I found the discussion really fascinating because, and I admit I'm exaggerating a bit, but it sets the point that we're trying to make. Janet Protasiewicz won a hard-fought election campaign. She'll take office August 1st. There are people, again, I'm exaggerating, but who think that maybe August 2nd we'll get rid of the gerrymandered maps in Wisconsin and the state's 1849 abortion ban, and it doesn't work that way. And other people are thinking, oh, maybe this will never happen and such. And you thought it would be good to take a few minutes and kind of help set the scene for what unfolds next and give people kind of a realistic view of what all is to follow. And you would know this because you have particular insight in some of the most recent progressives who have won Supreme Court races, right?
Yeah, no, I've had the honor of working on a few of these races and helping Janet win, helping Justice Karofsky, Justice Dalit win. And although I'm not a lawyer, I often play one on TV or on podcasts. And so I do think that it's important that people have an understanding of what the process is going to be in terms of how these cases move forward and what things can be, addressed pretty simply by the court and what might take a lot more effort and time. And so I think it's great that we can have this conversation.
Yeah, let's start with the maps. And in fact, the maps you have to break down two different ways. There's both the maps for the legislature and the maps for Congress. And so we might have to distinguish between those here. But as you know, you've been active in this around the state as advisory referendums and county board votes show tremendous support for either nonpartisan redistricting or just taking a stand against gerrymandering, which is purposefully rigging the maps to benefit, give a disproportionate share of votes to one party over the other. So clearly there's the public is on the side of advocates who want to see a change, but yeah, just because the public supports it doesn't mean it's going to happen instantly, right?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of really important points to make. One is that, in Wisconsin, over the modern history of politics, we had a tradition of fairly fair maps being drawn, which meant that when we had elections in Wisconsin, for a long time, up until about 2012, we were accurately reflecting the will of Wisconsin voters. But what happened in 2010 was really unique in that that was the first time that Wisconsin voters elected the same party to run both houses of the legislature and the governor's office in a census year. That had never actually happened before in modern times since we had the one person, one vote rule imposed by the U.S. Supreme Court more than 50 years ago. So Scott Walker and his allies rigged the maps, and they basically assured that Republicans would have big majorities in the legislature, even if the voters voted for Democrats to be in charge. And voters voted for Democrats to be in charge a couple of times in the decade of the 2010s, but Republicans remained in charge. In 2022, we had our first election under new maps after Tony Evers had been elected governor. But instead of the Republicans kind of being able to rig the maps on their own, the U.S. Supreme Court actually stepped in with one of the most political decisions we've ever seen. The conservative majority, the right-wing majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court kind of worked hand in hand with Republican legislators to make up some new rules, and they rigged the maps again. And so we once again have these massive Republican majorities in the Senate and the Assembly in the Wisconsin State Legislature, even though Wisconsin voters want to see a more 50-50 split in how things should be allocated. And that's also true in that the congressional map in Wisconsin, we're pretty 50-50 state. We're a state that Democrats have won, I think, 15 out of the last 18 statewide elections, but Republicans hold 6 out of the 8 congressional seats because they've rigged the maps. And so now I think people understand that there will be a new case brought. And so to just talk about that for a moment,
Before you do, because we're up against the break, so we've set the scene for it. So now we want to set the case, when something might get filed, how it all goes through the process. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick pause here. And then when we come back, we're going to get updated weatherology forecast for the weekend. Quick look at sports, temperatures around the state, and then more with Sachin Chetta next. You're up north. Have more about Janet Protasiewicz winning the state Supreme Court race and what that means when progressives take control of the state Supreme Court for the first time in many, many, many years. But before we do that, we're going to get an update on the weather forecast heading into the weekend, where right now it's a balmy 70 degrees here on Lake Wissota, Burlington at 59, Wittenberg 66, Marshfield 65, and the tickling of the 90s will be changing a bit here, and at least this very long dry spell may be coming to an end. Maybe. Let's find out the details from Jennifer Wojcicki with Weatherology. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, well, it looks like today's going to be an interesting day. Still looking at an air quality alert for the whole state today. The combination of the high temperatures and low humidity will lead to hazardous ozone layers. So people with respiratory issues, children and older adults are advised to decrease any prolonged activities outside today. There may be some areas of haze, particularly in the southern parts of the state today. Otherwise, it looks like the same sort of story today for most, as it has been all week for nearly everyone. Sunny skies for nearly everyone, highs in the mid-80s to low 90s, slightly cooler towards Lake Michigan. Slight chance for showers and storms coming in this afternoon around Amory and Baldwin, with some cloud cover moving through. Still a chance for showers and storms for Amory and Baldwin on Saturday. Temperatures not moving much from today. Then storm chances start to move through central Wisconsin Saturday afternoon, with, again, similar temperatures to today. Sunny and still hot in the south on Saturday, with a chance for those showers and storms coming in by the evening hours. There's also a marginal risk for severe weather for extreme western Wisconsin for tomorrow as well. Then on Sunday, to round out the weekend, it looks like starting to cool down across the board as a cold front begins to push through. Chance for showers and storms for everyone, with highs lingering a little bit cooler in the 70s. It's going to be slightly below average for this time of the year.
And it's got to be said that with that chance, people are going to be outside everywhere from Summerfest to Country Fest to all kinds of community festivals. So take that local forecast very seriously for alerts. Don't take anything for granted. And Jennifer, I'm sure the whole weatherology crew will be watching out for that. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thanks to you.
All right. Now let's check a quick check on sports for the Brewers. Not much to say. They were on the road yesterday. They're in Cleveland for a weekend series against the Guardians. The Bucks found out that Chris Middleton has opted to become a free agent. Doesn't mean that he's lost and moving on, but that he is going to test the marketplace. Meanwhile, in the draft, at the 58 spot, they picked up Chris Livingston from Kentucky, and they made a trade with Orlando with a 36th pick to get Andre Jackson Jr. from Orlando, the trade from Orlando, I should say. And we'll have more with Dan Schumacher coming up a little later on this hour, and Mark Jacob coming up at 7:30. But joining us for the rest of this half hour, Sachin Chetta, again, a progressive political consultant, a longtime advocate for fair maps. He's helped out with the election campaigns of now the three women who are or will be progressive Supreme Court justices here in Wisconsin. So, Sachin, before the break, we'd laid out the history of gerrymandering, how the maps got to be rigged in Wisconsin, and now we're getting to the point of how does the legal challenge work? And let me start it this way. Does the legal challenge itself, is it something that's already underway, or is it a case that is being prepared and will be filed sometime after August 1st?
Yeah, I don't know the exact timing, but an organization called Law Forward, I think, which is had folks on this podcast and across the progressive media sphere talk about what they do quite a bit. They've won a number of voting rights cases in Wisconsin. They've really become the leading law firm to ensure a strong democracy here. They've announced publicly that they're going to file a case. And what's unique about this case, as they've talked about it, is that it's going to be filed as a challenge under the state constitution. I think that that's really important because people need to understand that that really hasn't happened before. Folks want to say, well, these maps have been litigated, but there actually hasn't been clear litigation making a claim under the state constitution. And so that's what they've said publicly that they're going to do. That case will be filed, I think, around August 1st. I don't know if that means before or after. I'm not one of the parties to that case. I'm not a litigant. I'm not a lawyer. So they're going to kind of continue to tell the public story about what they're going to do. But I think what's important for people to understand is that what the Wisconsin Supreme Court will have to do then is kind of manage that case. And one of the things that the justices have said publicly, many of the justices who will kind of have effective control now, is that they want to return to regular order. What has happened under the right-wing majority is they've kind of short-circuited the legal processes over and over again to achieve their right-wing partisan ends. And the more progressive majority isn't like the exact opposite of that, where they're just going to rig the maps or they're going to decide cases instantly in favor of progressives. What they want to do is make sure that everybody, whether you're progressive or conservative, independent, whatever your political perspective, whatever your legal perspective, we want you to have confidence that you're going to be treated fairly by this court system and by the system in Wisconsin. And so that means you have to return to using those regular processes. It could mean cases now have to wind their way through the courts in a way that you know, if you had Justice Rebecca Bradley's way, that they wouldn't always do. She wants to always pull those cases out of circuit court and have the Wisconsin Supreme Court decide them immediately. I do think they understand that if they believe, and they haven't seen a case yet, they haven't made any decisions, but if they were to say that the Wisconsin state the constitution demands that the current maps should be thrown out because they're rigged, then we shouldn't go through another election under those maps. I think they understand conceptually, and they've talked about that. So the timeline is sometime over the next year, right? Because the next elections will be in August and November of 2024. But it's not something that they're just going to snap their fingers and change, whether we're talking the maps or any other issue, right? Those cases have to move their way through the courts.
But you know, again, the fast tracking, it does work both ways. This conservative court has fast tracked cases that probably should not have been, but they wanted to make a political statement. Right. So obviously there are folks who are saying, well, if you start this challenge, you know, say this August, mm-hmm. and if you know, the litigants are, you know, on the conservative side are allowed to drag this out, you know, conceivably we wouldn't have new maps for 2024. And then one of the progressive judges, Ann Walsh Bradley, is up in 2025. She could lose that election. And then, you know, the entire rigged map system just continues for the rest of the decade. So such in the question becomes, would there be a case where at some point you want the regular order, but won't there be pressure to fast track this before elections in 2024?
So I think you can do both, right? And again, I have confidence in the leaders that we've elected in recent years. We've elected four new justices, counting Brian Hagedorn, who's shown to be a swing vote on a few cases. We've elected three progressive judges since 2018. onto the court. It's really, it's a wholesale concern. I see in the Chiron there, it says ending more than 15 years of conservative control. I would argue that progressives have never had clear control of the court really in the history of the state in terms of how we look at the court. This is a new era that's going to be started on August 1st. And so what I would encourage people to do is have confidence. I think they should have confidence that you can do both, that you can have a return to regular order. You can have a court that respects the will of Wisconsin people, that respects the law, that respects the Constitution, that respects the processes that we've set forth so that everybody's treated fairly, right? The goal here isn't just for progressives to be treated fairly. We want everybody to be treated fairly. So, while at the same time recognizing that on the issue of fair maps, that if we believe and if the parties that bring the case prove that these maps are unconstitutional under the Wisconsin State Constitution, which is the claim that they say they're going to be bringing, that we should have confidence that this court can manage that in a timely way. But nobody can promise anything, right? This is not about the, and Janet's campaign and Joe Kurofsky's campaign, Becky Dowd's campaign, wasn't about promising outcomes. It was about promising a fair court. And I think that's what we're going to get. I want to point out that on abortion, that case is already winding its way.
Well, that's what I was going to get to next is that case is already coming. So it may that abortion ban case probably won't get to the state Supreme Court until there's been a change. Or do we think that between now and August 1st, there doesn't appear to be a chance that conservatives would pull
the matter. There are more oral argument dates set. There are a few decisions that are still yet to be issued, I think, into early July. But they're essentially at the end of their work for this term. So I don't think that you're going to see action on those cases prior to the fall term beginning in September. But I do think that case will happen earlier because, again, it's already winding its way through the process. The circuit court will make a decision and that will go to the appellate courts much sooner than any other case, I think.
One more note on the maps and distinguishing between the legislative and the congressional is this, I don't know if it's a theory or a guess, but that we should only be looking for changes in the legislative maps because of what the U.S. Supreme Court has already shown a right-wing bias when it comes to these fair maps. And if you stick to just the state legislative maps and don't touch the congressional ones, you don't give the U.S. Supreme Court any reason to interfere. What's your thought on that theory?
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm sure the lawyers who are listening are going to be like, why is this guy opining on this? I think it's fair to say I'm an expert on gerrymandering, but I'm not a lawyer, right? So what I'd say is this. I think that it is obvious, always possible, whether you're talking about a legislative map or a congressional map, frankly, whether you're talking about a school board map or a city council map, it is possible that that conversation, that litigation can implicate federal issues. It's always possible. It's almost sure that when you're talking about a congressional map, that it's going to implicate a federal issue because you're talking about a federal map. You're talking about a map to elect federal legislators in Congress, right? And so I think that's where people have talked about, look, if you are only talking about the legislative district map, maybe you can kind of avoid implicating any federal issue, trying to keep the U.S. Supreme Court out of it. And I think that makes some sense. I think my understanding, and again, I'm trying to reflect what's already been publicly said, is that it's just, you just do it as two different cases, right? There, I think a case will be brought on the legislative district maps and that will wind its way through the process. I think separately a case will be brought on the congressional maps and that will wind its way through the process. And I think the intention there is to say if the U.S. Supreme Court does what they've been doing, which is make expressly partisan political right-wing decisions intended to help Republicans, as they did in the Wisconsin map in 2022, if they do that on the congressional map, can we kind of keep them away from the state legislative map? But I think we should, here's one thing I want to leave you with, and I know we don't have a lot of time remaining, is I think we should have confidence. As citizens of Wisconsin, we should have confidence in the new court majority that they're going to do the right thing. They're going to follow the law. They're going to follow the Constitution. They're going to do what they were elected to do, which is make these hard decisions. I think we should have confidence in the lawyers, the progressive movement, is seeing lead this effort, which includes Law Forward and other organizations around the country. And I think they are all thinking about these issues. And what we as the public need to do is keep talking about them. We need to have public events, town halls, events at the library, talking to students about it. We want to make sure that all of this stuff happens with sunlight in the public view. And through the organization I work with, Fair Elections Project and others, we'd love to help you tell the story in your community to make sure that people understand what is happening.
All right. Sachin Chadha, thank you so much. I really appreciate all the background and the perspective as well. And keep us updated. Thank you again.
Thanks, Pat. Really appreciate it.
All right. And when we come back, Mark Jacob will join us and we will talk about the U.S. Supreme Court and some of the recent things we've learned about the conservative justices and what that says about media coverage of the court. That's up next. You're up north. I just figure anytime we're going to talk about the Supreme Court is reason enough to bring up the Supremes. On a Friday morning, 7:33, Mark Jacob joins us, as always, former Metro editor at the Chicago Tribune, former editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, author. You can find Mark on Twitter, at MarkJacob16. And his latest for Courier Newsroom, parent company of Up North News, is called The Conspiracy Candidate. And we'll get into that in a little bit as well. Mark, how are you?
I'm doing great.
All right. Well, I'm going to start with the Supreme Court simply because of a post that I saw on social media, and it really was an eye opener for me. After ProPublica runs what they've learned about Samuel Alito taking luxury trips from billionaires, and prior to that, it was Clarence Thomas, and of course, there was always suspicions about Antonin Scalia. And somebody posted, "What does this say about the people in," we always talk about the Capitol press corps, the White House press corps. There's a Supreme Court press corps. There are people that have covered the U.S. Supreme Court for decades, and they missed this entirely. What can we learn about the press corps of any given institution from the events this week?
I think you learn that, especially in certain areas of coverage, certain beats, that some of the reporters just simply don't want to be investigative reporters. You find that in sports a lot, where the reporter just wants to cover what happens between the lines. You know, doesn't want to cover anything outside the actual game, and doesn't want to dig deeply. Same thing true with the Supreme Court for many years. I mean, it's not just a Supreme Court scandal; it's a journalism scandal that this stuff took so long to come out. This is the latest Alito thing is a 2008 trip, so it's been out there a while. If I recall, Scalia died while he was on some sort of a little junket trip too. So, gotcha. I mean, it's not like we couldn't have figured out that these things happened and start asking better questions. There was even that thing with Nina Totenberg, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her name was brought up. Like, she's, like this star reporter. Where was she on this?
Well, and she had a longstanding conflict. And I mean, after Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, she revealed that she was big, close pals with Ruth Bader Ginsburg the whole time. And give me a break. I mean, that's fine. Have a friendship. Great. Cover something else. Well, you're covering the Supreme Court and you're like best buddies with one of the justices. I mean, that's ridiculous. That would any good editor would have said, Nina, you got another beat. Go find something else to cover. Because that's just not how it's done in ethical journalism.
Here's what I don't understand and will never understand, despite, decades in journalism and in politics, is what becomes a quote unquote story, a big story, and what does not. That we have essentially corruption at the U.S. Supreme Court gets a little bit of play here and there. But as you point out in your column for Courier Newsroom about the conspiracy candidate, there are so many other conspiracies and things that by any objective standard are not a big story and arguably not a story at all. Like in the column, you talk about Obama and birtherism, and yet that gets play. And you kind of put that out there in this column to newsrooms to say, do better.
Yeah. I wrote that because I was thinking of the latest Joe Rogan thing where he's trying to get Peter Hotez to debate RFK Jr. about vaccines. Well, that's not going to be an honest debate. And I'm really glad to see Hotez said, no way, I'm not going to do that. And it reminded me that people who have crazy theories with no evidence behind it always want to debate you about it. I mean, they're happy to, because that debate is going to elevate them, and it's going to create this kind of false equivalency between them and kind of real fact-based stuff. And it reminded me of when I was at the Chicago Tribune, this is back in 08, and when Obama was running for president, and that whole birtherism thing came out, you know, he was born in Kenya, et cetera, except Pat, you know, oddly enough, there was a birth announcement in the Honolulu Advertiser newspaper back in 61 when he was born. So, I mean, in order for it to be some sort of big, vast conspiracy, you would have to think that somebody in 1961 thought, let's put an announcement in a newspaper so that a half-black candidate with an unusual name can run for president, you know, 37 years later. I mean, it's a stupid theory. It never should have, you know, been pushed around the way it was. Yet, when I was an editor at the Tribune, the higher-ups ordered me and a reporter to work on a story about it. And, you know, I edited it. He wrote the story, and he called around to officials in Hawaii and all this other stuff. And the real takeaway of that story was, no, there's probably nothing to this. But it didn't kill the rumor. It didn't clarify anything for anyone. All it did is further elevate it, further get it in, you know, this toxin into the mainstream. And, you know, a few years later, Donald Trump made it his big drum to beat on, you know, so that he became, you know, a big shot, could go on TV and talk about how a very credible source had told him that Obama's birth certificate was fake.
Well, and you have the way that the story is packaged. And as you note in the column, the headline on the story was "Rumor Calls Obama's Birth Certificate Fake." And again, it kind of shows the both sidesism. You don't want to appear biased. And yet, I would argue the story should have been packaged as who is lying about Obama's birth, you know, because that to me is the real story. But as we've talked about in the past, it sounds like you're taking a side. Well, yeah, you're taking the side of facts.
Right. Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is I look back on that story and I don't like it very much. And I'm not really very happy with my performance on that story because, yeah, that's a stupid headline that kind of, and also, why are we writing about rumors? Why? Right. And we also, you're totally right. We didn't go after the people spreading the rumors. Well, go at them. Ask them, where are your facts? Why do you think this? You know, well, and
especially when you consider, like you note, we went through this earlier with John Kerry and the Swift boat, boating, now a verb. We knew that these kinds of dirty tricks exist. And yet, again, when John Kerry was running, not nearly enough was said to put the spotlight on people intentionally lying, but instead to say, hey, there's this thing out here. We looked at it. It's not true. That's, you know.
Right.
Such an
interesting thing about the Swift boating thing is that a guy we worked with at the Tribune was a Vietnam vet who had been in the same area of Vietnam as Kerry during that time. But he didn't work in the Nation World section where I worked in. And he came over after this Swift boat thing was out there for a week or so. He came over and he said, hey, I was there. What Kerry did was, you know, was brave and meritorious. This is all baloney. This is all lies. And he didn't want to get involved. He's in the news media. He did not want to become part of the story. Eventually he wrote something for the Tribune saying that, but again, the news media they don't want to be the story. They would rather cover it. And sometimes they're very hesitant to, you know, to call out the liars.
Unfortunately, getting back to, this all started with the news story about Samuel Alito. Now, when he heard that, you know, there was this story in the works about him, and I'm sure he was approached for, you know, reaction and quotes to the story. And instead, he decided to basically scoop them by doing a pre-buttal. Right. And the Wall Street Journal, you know, did him a big favor and published it for him, you know, basically forcing the story to be released. And there's a lot of people saying that what the Wall Street Journal did was, I don't know if unethical is the right word, but basically when you undercut another newsroom by doing a pre-buttal, is that fair criticism of the Journal?
Oh, I think so. Big time. I mean, the Journal is kind of a weird entity because, you know, it has very good investigative reporters and just general economics reporters, but its editorial side is right wing Rupert Murdoch garbage, and it not fact based, just kind of makes up stuff, and I mean it's terrible. It's just terrible. And in this case, Samuel Alito knew exactly who to go to, And this is, you know, I experienced this when I was at the Chicago Tribune. We would find out something about Rahm Emanuel and who was really liked to work the press. And when we found out, of course, ethical newspaper people, when they find out something, they go to the source of somebody who's accused of something, and they say, hey, this is what we found out. Do you have a comment on it? Do you want to confirm it? Do you want to dispute anything in it? This is good journalism in a couple ways. One, you never want to surprise somebody. You want to, if you've got something, tell them. If you're gonna, they're gonna look bad. They would rather know beforehand. And also it's good journalism because sometimes they'll say, no, that's not exactly right. This is right. And sometimes you can avoid mistakes by going to the target of your journalistic investigation and just going straight up on them and telling them what you have. The real risk there is that if they're kind of unethical, like Samuel Alito, they'll immediately go to a favorite news outlet, and that news outlet will run cover for them. We'll do a pre-buttal like that. And that's, you know, that's the Wall Street Journal being more political than journalistic. You know, that's then in effect trying to jackpot another news organization just because they're too busy being right-wing advocates rather than journalists.
Exactly. And if we learned nothing else good from this entire Alito episode, based on his defense of accepting the free trip, is that the next time you get on an airplane, and if you're in coach, but you see an empty first class seat, you can go ahead and take it because apparently it's free.
Because that seat would be vacant if you didn't sit in it. And so you must sit in it. That's it. There's no problem with that. You know, and do you really, do you want a Supreme Court justice who thinks that's logical? That well, it's okay for me to take this big freebie trip, you know, worth tens of thousands, if not $100,000, to go fishing with, you know, important right wing people. It's okay for me to do that and not disclose it because that seat would have been vacant if I hadn't taken it.
That's wacky. That should be, in my mind, such a bigger story. But let's move on to another one that you've stayed on top of far better than me. We all try to keep as many plates spinning as we can. And I will admit that one of the plates I have not been doing much spinning on is this group called No Labels. And look, not everybody, but a lot of people want that white knight, that savior, that, you know, lone ranger riding to the rescue, who is so thoroughly moderate and can fairly judge people in both parties. And you and others are saying No Labels ain't that.
Well, yeah, No Labels is this group that kind of was formed to try to say, well, this, we have such, you know, horrible partisanship and such enmity between the two main political parties that we're going to do something that's trying to moderate and centrist and reasonable, and we're going to like push for that kind of politics. And it's not a political party, and it doesn't have the same rules of disclosure. And at this point, they don't have to disclose who their donors are, and they've refused to disclose who their donors are. And there are strong suspicions that a lot of, you know, right-wing rich people are giving them money because they want them to run a candidate in next year's election. And there's been talk about Joe Manchin being that candidate because he's a Democrat. He's a Democrat in name who really is more of a Republican. And what people think the net result, if this actually got going, is that it would take more votes away from Biden than Trump, and it might get Trump elected. The funny thing to me is that I think Biden's a moderate. I mean, if you look at him in the Democratic Party, he's fended off the progressives on a number of issues. And if you look at his whole history, I mean, it's very moderate. I mean, he's just a moderate Democrat. So I don't know what they're going for, other than I really feel strongly, and a lot of other people do too, that it's a right-wing operation just designed to pretend to be centrist, but really to get Trump reelected.
Sure. Got time quickly just for one note of things that were done. For example, House Republicans censuring California Democrat Adam Schiff for conduct during the impeachment. But as you retweeted and many of us others noted, the whole no collusion with Russia thing is such garbage. It was proven over and over again. But it was Trump's attorney general who essentially covered up that very significant talking point.
Right. I mean, exactly. I mean, you know, you've got an email that was actually released by Donald Trump Jr. He was forced to because it was going to be released anyway. But he released an email that he sent that said, if you've got dirt on Hillary Clinton, we love it. And he met with the Russians. I mean, that really happened. And the thing is because of where we live in this disinformation society, they want to pretend that didn't happen. Also, Pat, let's remember that the Mueller report demonstrated that mm-hmm. the Trump campaign shared polling information yes. with Russian operatives.
And not once did they contact the FBI to say, hey, this is right. a bad deal. Right. Mark Jacob, thank you so much. Always great to talk to you. Have a good weekend.
Talk to you.
All right. When we come back, Dan Schumacher joins us. And we've missed him for a couple of weeks because he's been wrapping up his retirement and being unretired. We'll find out more and talk sports next. You're up north. There was one note about history that I didn't share an hour ago, and it was sports history. I thought I'd bring it up here. It was on this day in 1917 that Boston Red Sox pitcher Ernie Shore kind of sort of had a perfect game. He retired 26 batters in a row. Why didn't he retire 27 batters in a row? Well, because he wasn't actually the starting pitcher. The starting pitcher pitched to one batter. His name was Babe Ruth. He got ejected from the game for punching the umpire. And so then Ernie Shore had to come in and basically pitch a perfect game in relief on this day in 1917. Sportsman, you never know. And speaking of sportsman, you never know. Here's ex-retiree Dan Schumacher, who if you're watching on the video feed now, you see that his screen name says Executive Director of Athletics, Northland College. You are now a fine resident of Ashland, Wisconsin, are you not?
I am during the week. There's no yes. doubt about it.
And, yeah. So tell us about this. This is a nice change for you.
Yeah, it is. It's nice. It's a nice opportunity to come to a new place and meet some new people. There's challenges for sure with the job. Wasn't expecting this to come to me, but it did. Received a phone call shortly after retirement, and they want me to expand the sports module here. So that would include, starting college football. They have a brand new football stadium that was built right at COVID, but COVID ruined all their plans. So most of my forte at most of the schools over my years, I've been able to start sports. At Eau Claire, I started three. Chicago State, I started two. The list goes on and on with the four or five schools that I've been to. So
you go to these mid-sized schools and you build an entire sports program almost from scratch. And that's what you're going to do for football up at Northland.
Football, wrestling, yep. And then we'll look at some other things as things progress. But, I've been sitting with the Board of Trustees here for the last 2 days. People that have their names on buildings around here. And they're willing to do what they have to do because – of course, at Northland College, only has 750 students, and everybody's worried about enrollment. I think, Pat, we've talked about this before, about the enrollment cliff of 2025, where every college is going to be under this scrutiny and this pressure. So small schools like that, I mean, look at Finlandia closed. Cardinal Stritch down in Milwaukee closed. They're all struggling for enrollment and keeping the doors open.
And so you're looking for opportunities for students to say, hey, I would like to go because I get a chance to do this. And yes. there are many other things that you can do in academics and research and student life and everything. But athletics is one of those things. And if a college or university wants to build up something in athletics, you're clearly somebody that's got some experience doing that. So now you're doing it in one of the most, beautiful places on earth. How's life been just getting used to Ashland, Wisconsin for the first couple of weeks? Couldn't have picked a better time of year for it.
I know. I never imagined. I mean, 3 weeks ago when I was up here to start the process, it was 55 degrees. I was wearing a coat, in the beginning of June. Now, last night, I was in shorts and a golf shirt, and it was 90 to 88 degrees. It was unbelievable. So even for being right on – and Lake Superior was like glass last night. It was just absolutely gorgeous. And it's a wonderful town. I've never spent any real time here. I've driven through it. I've spent more time in Bayfield, just north of here, and Madeline Island and the Apostle Islands. But, yeah, there's a wide variety. I will tell you, the wide variety of people here, I see a lot of Minnesota plates.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of Minnesota plates.
A lot of folks wander over, you know, from the Twin Cities as well as from Duluth Superior. And I have to say, when campaigning for Congress in 2012, while I lived in Chippewa Falls, a lot of what I did was based out of Wausau because of its central location. But if I'd have had my druthers, I'd have run that whole campaign out of Ashland because it's such a beautiful place, great people. You know, you can still get all over northern Wisconsin from there. Yep. And, you know, just a great place to, you know, put down some stakes for a while. So I wish you all the best in that.
I appreciate that. Now I just got to find a place to live because I'm living in a dorm right now. And I'm not kidding you, Pat. There is no houses for sale up here.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I've seen only two rentals that I visited, and they were not quality rentals. Mm-hmm. And I talked to the community members, and some of the people were like, it's the biggest problem since COVID up here. People came up here and bought up homes, and now they Airbnb all their homes. It's becoming more and more touristy here, and it's just hard to find housing in general for everybody. People around here live in Washburn. They live over in Ironwood. You know, they're making those drives because there's housing in those areas. So it's an interesting place that I never thought that you'd have a problem finding a place to live in Ashland, Wisconsin.
Oh yeah, and I'm sorry that you're going through the problem, but I'm glad we're discussing it here because it's something we talked about quite a bit in maybe months past, and it hasn't received as much attention. But there are plenty of small and mid-sized places in Wisconsin that have a real housing shortage. These are places that are attracting people, but it's hard to attract workers, you know, when there's such a housing shortage in places. And yep. That part is as true as ever. Let's do a little bit of nominal sports here. The Brewers were off yesterday. They're in Cleveland to take on the Guardians for this weekend. Then they head off to New York to take on the Mets and then Pittsburgh to play the Pirates later on next week. The NBA draft, I guess, was yesterday. The Bucks picked up a couple of players. They got Chris Livingston from Kentucky with the number 58 pick. And then with the number 36 pick, they actually got that traded from Orlando. They had picked up Andre Jackson Jr. And meanwhile, Chris Middleton has opted to become a free agent. Doesn't mean that he's necessarily going to leave, but certainly going to test the waters. I am guessing with all your new duties, you didn't really have you know, much time to watch the NBA draft or give us any kind of insight.
I actually did watch it because I love the fashion to it. To be honest,
talked about that draft day being a show.
I try to compare it because I think the NBA from a fashion standpoint, what they wear, I think trumps the NFL draft.
Wow, and because
those are the guys in the NFL, they're all sassed up and the jewelry and the whole nine yards. And boy, some of the things that people were wearing last night in the interviews, I was just like, holy cow! You know, who even thinks of this stuff? But I did watch a little bit of it. I thought it was interesting. A lot of G League players got drafted.
Okay.
And like the Thompson twins, I think is a great story. So the NBA draft was actually intriguing last night. I didn't get a real good chance to watch the finals, especially the last game with the Nuggets. Mm-hmm. But last night was interesting to watch all those people and the way they handled themselves and the way the NBA came across on ESPN to the world.
There's always a next big thing, and I'm very curious to see if this Victor Wembanyama is going to live up to the hype, because there's a lot of hype about that guy that we'll be following. All right, Dan. Well, hey, congratulations again. This is really nice news, and we're going to get a whole new perspective on sports from the standpoint of what you're building up there at Northern College. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Pat. Have a good one.
Yeah, stay safe when you're traveling back here for a visit real soon. All right, that's going to do it for us today. Coming up on Monday, the ongoing battle to save a program that keeps childcare affordable to working families. Just remember, you can follow us all day long. Our website is upnorthnewswi.com, or find us at upnorthnewswi on social media. Sign up for our newsletter at the website. You can follow some of my political musings on Facebook at Pat Kreitlow Up North. That's all one word. People of the pod, we love every download. Thank you. Come back again soon. And if you're listening live, keep that radio right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Have a great weekend. See you Monday.